Good morning. See everybody got up on a nice, bright, and early morning here in Washington, D.C. during July. We're excited to have you here. I'm Steve Chaney. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the American Security Project. If you're not familiar with ASP, we were founded in 2006, and the premise behind this is that we'll take topical issues and put them into a national security perspective. Energy security, nuclear security, climate change, terrorism, asymmetric operations are all a number of the issues that we take on. Today, we're particularly pleased to have Representative Adam Smith here to talk about sub-Saharan Africa. We think this is a very topical issue, especially when it relates to asymmetric operations. We're pleased that you are here today. This is kind of a watershed event for us here at ASP because we're way oversubscribed, and Congressman, I attribute that to your infinite popularity. I'm also pleased to introduce one of our board members and a managing partner of McLarty Associates, Nelson Cunningham, who is my boss. He's on the board here and who's been a good friend for a long time. Nelson.
Thanks very much, Steve. I have been a board member of ASP since its founding, and one of the reasons why I'm so active with the organization and remain so proud of what it does is because it's one of the few places in Washington where you get people from at the board level from both sides of the political aisle to sit down and actually find common sense, consensus solutions to complicated national security problems. Our board is one-third Democratic-leaning, one-third Republican-leaning, and then most importantly, one-third retired flag officers. And it's the flag officers who give us really the steel underpinning for our policies because they constantly bring us back to reality and focus us on the real needs of American security. And then it's up to the rest of the board to come up with ways in which we can agree to advance those goals rather than find ways to disagree on how to advance those goals. And that's why I'm particularly proud to be here and with General Cheney and his leadership. I'm also proud to be introducing someone I have known and admired and respected for a long time, Congressman Adam Smith. He has been, since coming to Congress, first being elected in 1996, at the age of 31?
Yes.
Yeah. 31. I came to Washington right about the same time, and I was a Senate staffer. He was a congressman. But he has been, ever since coming to Congress, he has been one of the really thoughtful folks who, as a Democrat, spends most of his time thinking about the same sort of common sense, practical solutions to problems that I think are the place where solutions really can be found. We first worked together on trade matters back in the 1990s when Bill Clinton was reaching across the aisle to push a broad trade agenda, and Adam Smith was one of the most thoughtful people in the House, leading Democrats to a new and, I think, better place on trade, being more open, more globalized, and leaning forward on an issue on which Democrats had often been going in a different direction. He has taken that same broad-ranging sense of intellect and policy to his role on the Armed Services Committee. He has served on the committee since he first came to Congress in 1997. He has now risen to the position of ranking member on the committee. Should certain things happen in November, he would be the chairman, and I'd be certainly proud to call him chairman. I think it is telling that in his work on the Armed Services Committee, he has taken the same sort of broad-gauged approach toward thinking about national security problems that he took to the trade, dealing with trade problems in other parts of his congressional career. And I think it's particularly telling, Mr. Smith, that you're here to talk to us about AFRICOM, because Africa is a place where national security, development, diplomacy, poverty alleviation, healthcare resources all need to be addressed in a holistic fashion. And we can't just view it as a place for military forces, but we need to have a policy that allows us to approach it holistically to solve its problems. Mr. Smith has recently returned from his second trip to Africa. He was in Uganda. I'm sure we'll hear about that trip. Please join me in welcoming Ranking Member Congressman Adam Smith.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here, and I've enjoyed working with Nelson ever since I did get to Congress. And I think this organization is a great model for the way we need to do business in Washington, D.C., and too infrequently do. And that is work together to solve problems. I first got involved and met Nelson through the New Democrat Coalition caucus that we've worked with and a couple other organizations that we're affiliated with. And I always said the thing I loved about that group is you get to Washington, D.C., just about every meeting you can go to is talking about partisan advantage. Well, if we put this forward, this will really put those guys in a box. You know, I went to the New Democrats and they were talking about policies. They were talking about solutions. They were talking about how can we make things work better, which is why I got into politics in the first place and is what I think the American people expect from us far more often than they get. So it's terrific that you're involved in this organization. It's also a great opportunity in the Armed Services Committee. I always say that the Armed Services Committee is the most bipartisan committee in Congress. I hasten to add that that's a very low bar to jump over at this point. But it is a committee that prides itself on working across party lines. Every chairman, every ranking member of that committee, number one at the top of their list is they have that history, the history that this committee works together, gets past partisanship, puts national security first. Now, it's not that we don't fight and argue about things, but it is a priority to find ways to work together in a way that I've not seen in any other committee. So between working with the New Democrats and Nelson being on the Armed Services Committee, I've been very blessed to have that opportunity, I think more so than most members of Congress. Well, I'm here this morning to talk about AFRCOM, and Nelson, I think, did a good job of sort of outlining it. I think the role of AFRICOM and the role of DOD in Africa is a great model for how we need to engage in foreign policy and national security broadly for a number of different reasons. Chief among them is the whole of government approach that Nelson outlined and that I'll talk more about. But overlaying all of this as we talk about Africa is we have to recognize and look at Africa as an opportunity. I think too often in national security policy, we look out the world, well, challenge here, challenge there, got to fix that problem, got to fix that problem. I think if we're really going to build the type of partnerships that we need, and the single most important partnership in national security is the partnership that you build with the country in question, and not just with your own agencies and not just with other countries, but to recognize that this is a partnership that puts the other nation first. And if we take that look and take that approach, I think we'll be able to build the type of strong relationships that are necessary. But Africa is an enormous amount of opportunity. That's something that has struck me in reading about it, and certainly in both times that I was there. It is rich in resources, and it is also rich in human resources. And the people there are incredibly anxious to grow and create greater opportunity, and they're starting to do it. So when we look at Africa, we have to look at it through that lens. As an opportunity for a partnership that's going to be mutually beneficial and for growth. And you can see that in some of our global economic competitors. China, India, even Brazil now are really starting to expand their efforts in Africa. They're investing, they're building infrastructure, they're setting up partnerships because they see the opportunity of this emerging market. One of the things that you learn, and this sort of takes me back to the trade world, if you get there first, branding is really important. If they start buying your products and relying on you and your companies, it tends to last. Not forever. Nothing does. Competition comes up, but it gives you an opportunity. So I think we need to engage and see it as that opportunity. So to look through the lens of AFRICOM and what we're doing on the defense side to get an idea of how it then flows into all of those other issues that I just mentioned, I think the Horn of Africa is a pretty good place to start our look. And I think we've been largely successful there in building the type of partnerships that are necessary. We have, in trying to deal with Somalia and then right across the water in Yemen, recognized that to be successful there, we need friends and we need allies. And we have done that with Kenya, with Ethiopia, with Uganda, with Djibouti. Those partnerships, and then more broadly with ANASOM, we've built a coalition that has really been very successful in both Somalia and in Yemen, in containing a national security threat to us, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and Al-Shabaab more specifically in Somalia. We really started to have success. But that success has come because of our local partners there, and because we developed that security partnership. And this is the most important model, I think, when you look forward and say, okay, next 10 years, in an atmosphere of very scarce resources, what is our best national security posture? What's going to work for us to advance our interests? What's going to work is building those partnerships that become force multipliers for our interests. It is vastly, vastly better to have had the success that we've had in Somalia and Yemen for the relatively small amount of resources and the relatively small amount of troops than to have to plop down between 100 and 200,000 U.S. troops in a place like Afghanistan or Iraq and fight it out for a decade. The results are nowhere near as good, and the costs are just unimaginable. What we've done in Africa is we've done it in a partnership-building way, which is the only way you can really succeed. We are past the point in history where a foreign military force can simply impose its will on a country and fix everything. It can't be done. I would say that one of the things I really admire about the U.S. military is the answer to the question, can you do this, is always yes. It's almost, it's astonishing. It's like, I've traveled with them a great deal, so I'm talking about problems large and small, you know. Certainly, can you take that hill? Yes. But even small logistical things, they always believe that there's a way to do it. And that is an incredible strength. It also reaches the point where it becomes a little bit of a weakness. Because the truth of the matter is, the answer is sometimes no. No, you cannot pacify a place like Afghanistan with another 10,000 troops or another 20 or another 100 or another 20 years. You can't. There is a point at which military might is no longer going to be able to achieve your objective, and you need to recognize that. What works, and what really, really worked for us in the Horn of Africa, is building those partnerships so that it is Ethiopia, it is Kenya, it is Ugandan special forces that have played a critical, critical role in turning back al-Shabaab in Mogadishu and elsewhere in Somalia. It is those local forces being committed to the effort that enables you to succeed. And that is, you know, sort of basic counterinsurgency. And one of the things that I'm deeply concerned about as a result of Iraq and Afghanistan is that counterinsurgency has become very misunderstood and given a bad name. Counterinsurgency has become almost synonymous in the minds of some folks of nation building, with the notion of, you know, rebuilding Iraq or rebuilding Afghanistan. And really, in its most basic form, what it is it's building those local partnerships, as the Special Operations Command says, by, through, and with. Ideally, your forces, you don't ever fire a shot. You train first the local security forces, because you cannot have growth and opportunity if you don't have security. So we build those partnerships, you train security, but then you do all of those other things that Nelson talked about as well, that are necessary to build a successful civil society. You build infrastructure, you create a good education system, you make sure there's adequate health care. And in building those relationships, you're able to both achieve your security aims and build a lasting partnership that can help you in a wide variety of different ways. And that's what we're trying to do, and in some cases, I believe, succeeding in Africa, certainly in the Horn of Africa. Now, we have to be mindful that our interests will spread. The other area where we now need to really work on building partnerships is in Al-Qaeda in the land of the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, with what's going on in Mali, has been going on in Algeria and Nigeria as well. There are concerns rising there. But again, overarching all of this, yes, our concern is the rise of extremism and Al-Qaeda affiliates in this part. But look at it as a way to build partnerships that can lead to much, much more, that can lead to economic opportunity. And one of the keys to this, when I traveled to Africa the first time several years ago, went to a variety of different countries looking at how our Special Operations Command, broader DOD, State Department, our intel partners, how did they all work together? And that has always been, you know, a great challenge in the United States government. Get stovepiped, everyone's doing their own thing, State Department doesn't trust DOD, DOD doesn't trust intel, nobody trusts the special operations guys, because back in the day, nobody knew exactly what they were doing. That's all getting a lot better. Now, we've got a long way to go. There are still, you know, historical, you know, stovepipes that are there in terms of people understanding their particular field. But if you get all of those folks working together in a cooperative way, you can both present a more secure environment so that the terrorist threat that we're concerned about doesn't grow. You can create economic opportunity for all of us, build a more successful country, and also build partnerships and friends. You know, one of the biggest reasons that I've read that India is actively engaged in Africa is they're looking for friends and partners when it comes to international votes. Most specifically, they'd like to be on the UN National Security Council, Security Council. And, you know, everyone gets a vote. There's well over 50 countries in Africa. Make some friends, they get a vote. And that impacts us as well. We're very concerned about dealing with Iran, dealing with North Korea, working towards a better relationship with China. And all of those things, international organizations are going to be critical. Lots of countries get a vote. There's a lot of countries in Africa. If you have a good relationship there, you can get a vote on a key issue that enables you to meet your national security interests. So all of that comes together. And the role the DoD has to play is, number one, training the security force, but number two, being smart enough to know the partners that they need to succeed more broadly and when to stand down and let development agencies, let the State Department take the lead and work in that cooperative way. I believe Africa has served as a great model to accomplish those objectives. Now, while we're doing this, is one thing that's really important in terms of how DoD approaches this. The continent of Africa did not react positively when we created AFRICOM, and that was somewhat surprising to people in the Department of Defense. There were some bad initial aspects of the rollout, but overall, the notion that the U.S. military was all of a sudden taking an interest in your region has historically not been a positive, and I think we need to understand that. We have in the past trained security forces and worked with different groups in a way that wasn't necessarily in the best interests of the population. And that's the key to how we build this. And that is why when you start talking about USAID, development, US businesses, economics, in a broader approach, that works. Because we have to make it clear that we're trying to help the African people, not just prop up a dictator to do our bidding. The people are going to be very, very leery of that. So it doesn't just matter that we get a good partner in a given country. It matters that they're running that country well. And we have to be invested in that and working with them to come up with the proper development policy to help them do that. For instance, you know, as I mentioned, we've got a great partner in Kenya. They certainly have challenges, but they've worked very closely with us on Somalia and a wide variety of other issues. They've got a really important election coming up next year. And you know, they're very concerned about it. They're spending an enormous amount of time in Kenya, not just on the election, but as we all learned what comes next? Because after the last election, there was not a clear result, and there was massive violence in the country and unrest that undermined the stability of the country. We've got to help them build democratic institutions and build an understanding of how to succeed. And one of the great challenges that Africa has had is having that sustainability. You will have these periods of time when a government emerges in a given country that succeeds, and it's great for 4, 5, 6, 7 years, but then the transition of power is always difficult. Whoever is in power seems to want to hold on forever, not to want to transition, or nothing is really ready to come next, and it falls apart. That's when a country really succeeds. So there's a great line that I read in Tip O'Neill's book a long time ago, that one of the moment that he knew America was just an unbelievably great country was right after the impeachment of Richard Nixon. Drove around Washington, D.C., and you wouldn't have known it happened. Now, it happened, we moved on to the next government, and everything kept flowing. That is not to be taken for granted. I also say that, you know, I used to say that Abraham Lincoln was my favorite president, but the more I read about George Washington, I elevated him, because to have walked away from power voluntarily when he could have kept it at that moment in history was, I believe, unprecedented. But to do that, to be able to transition to the next government in a seamless way is critical to long-term security, and we can help with that. We can do the democracy building, and we can work on that. It's not an easy problem to solve, but it recognizes that our interests in Africa have to be beyond just, okay, that's the person in charge, let's make whatever deal we have to make with them in order to get their allegiance. We have to build broader support for the people. And that's all the whole of government pieces that are going out there. The one really missing piece of this right now is more robust engagement from the US business community. They're not as actively engaged there as China or India or some other countries. And I think there is opportunity there. We need to work in partnership with them as well. So underpinning all of this, I do believe the Department of Defense has a strong role to play. AFRICOM has a strong role. Like I said, number one, if you don't have security, you don't have stability, we can do that. We can train the local police forces in a way, the local military forces in a way that help bring security. But if that's not tied to a broader effort at more successful democracy, at more successful economics, it won't last, and we won't ultimately have the support of the African people that we need to be successful. So I think we've got a great opportunity in Africa, a number of different issues going on. Every country is different, but that broad model of partnership building, of a whole of government approach, and of recognizing the most important thing is what can we do to help the local country? It's not just about our interests. It's about making sure that we're serving theirs so that we can build a successful partnership going forward. And there is an enormous amount of opportunity in that region. In fact, I do want to close with one specific example of where I think we can move forward and make this better, and that's the Congo. The Eastern Congo has been the site of one of the greatest humanitarian crises of the last 20 years that very few people know about. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 million people have been killed in a wide variety of conflicts. A good chunk of it spilling out from the genocide in Rwanda, but you also have the Lord's Resistance Army spilling over from Uganda. Basically, you have this vast, ungoverned space in the Eastern Congo, and every rogue group or warlord that's looking for a safe place to hang out tends to head in that direction. It has led to an incredibly violent situation, hundreds of thousands of internally displaced people. And the real sad part about it is this is an incredibly resource-rich region. There's an enormous amount of opportunity there that's not being realized because first and foremost, there is not security. There's a lot of different issues in different countries and different places. In the Eastern Congo, it starts with security. So what can we do about it? How does all the other things that we're doing down there and that AFRICOM are doing tie into this? It ties in because if we can build security partnerships, hopefully eventually with the Congolese military, that's not easy, but also with the countries around it, with Uganda, with Rwanda, you can begin to bring security to the region by training the local population in how to bring security to the region. And if you bring security, the opportunity flows from there. So it was one of my hopes that the partnerships that we've built, first to try to contain Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Al-Shabaab, now we're working on a partnership to try to contain the Lord's Resistance Army, that those partnerships can lead to a broader set of partnerships that can begin to bring some measure of security and peace to the Eastern Congo. There's an enormous amount of opportunity in that region. It's, I could be off here, 6 or 7 different countries that come together in that one area. It could bring greater stability and greater opportunity to us and build the type of partnerships that would be beneficial to our economic interests and to our national security at the same time. That is but one example. There are many, many others. But that, I think, is a model for where we can go and how AFRICOM and the U.S. Department of Defense can be helpful in building a better Africa and building a better partnership for us. I would say that it's the Q&A that's the most interesting part of this, so I try not to go on and on and on. That's why I never ran for the Senate. Just kidding. So I look forward to your comments, questions, and ideas about this, and to working with all of you. I see many familiar faces out in the audience. I think policy in Africa is going to be a critical part of our national security and economic future, and we'll continue to work on this. So thank you for the opportunity to say a few words, and I look forward to your questions.
Well, thanks very much, Congressman. We do have, I think we've got you till about 9:30, so we're going to have plenty of time for Q&A. There's a lot of you standing in the back. There's a front row of seats here. They have reserved signs on it. I've just declared they're reserved for anyone who's been standing in the back. So please come up and grab a seat so that you have a better vantage point. If I could ask the first question, you know, in my day job, and you touched on this, in my day job at McCarty Associates, we advise companies, mostly U.S. companies, on their global strategies. And until four or five years ago, Africa didn't play in the parts of the world that companies asked us about. They'd ask us about South Asia, East Asia, Latin America, Mideast, not Sub-Saharan Africa. That really has changed. My colleague, Lebet Torbati, who's a former South African diplomat, is here. My colleague, Jim Dunlap at the Scowcroft Group, who runs their Africa practice, is here. We now find ourselves focusing commercially on Africa across a broad range, not just the energy companies, not just the mining companies, but companies like Walmart and Google and MetLife who are looking at Africa as opportunities. Now, you mentioned that the business community hasn't really quite done what they might do to sustain and support the broad approach that AFRICOM is helping to support. What could the business community do in Africa that could join forces with the other policies that you put forward? What can we do?
Well, I think the way that can work is through the security partnerships, through some development, you know, we can build a secure enough environment for folks to do business. And then they just have to take the leap of faith to go in and do business in a place where they haven't been before. But the thing to think about is this is a massive emerging middle class. I read the numbers. I forget exactly what they are. I think the estimates are something like a third of the population in Africa now is part of the middle class. That's a third of a population of over, you know, 300-400 million people. They are an emerging market, and that's why China's there. That's why India is there. They see them as an emerging market with opportunities. And I think you need to just start doing business and pick those places where you can begin to build those relationships. I will say the biggest challenge there is infrastructure. And that is the challenge. I think some degree that's what holds back a lot of people from investing there. Is, well, when I was in Uganda, they were talking about Uganda is the second largest producer of bananas in the world and eminently exportable crop. They don't export too many of them because they have a hard time getting them where they need to go. Roads, bridges, ports. There's a metaphor here, by the way, for the United States investing in infrastructure at this time, but that's a different topic. I won't get into that. But that's the biggest thing they need, building infrastructure. And what China and these other countries have done, they've invested in the infrastructure. They've set up the businesses and said, we're going to do business there. This is what you need. We'll build the road. We'll build the bridge. We'll help you develop the port. I think we need to be willing to make that investment as well to build a relationship and build out a partnership. But the simple answer is get in, invest, get started. Because I think there is an opportunity, particularly if you take it in a way that builds that relationship. Because even though China is present and China is, you know, growing in, you know, the export market for Africa, there's some resentment as well. As China tends to come in, they only want to hire Chinese nationals. They bring them in, and it has sort of an exploitation feel to it, which Africa has felt far, far too many times in the past. I think if we come in with the broader whole of government U.S. business approach that says we're looking after your interests as well as ours, I think there's an opportunity to come up with a different model that will work better than what China's doing right now. I think we should take that chance.
You put your finger on something that our clients talk to us about all the time, which is corruption, rule of law, and institutions. The first question is, can we do business in Africa in a way that isn't going to send us all to jail? And I think that really is the key, helping to build that legal infrastructure. Plenty of time for questions. I think, do we have a microphone that will go around? No? No microphones?
So they'll have to speak up loud and identify themselves.
Yeah, okay. Exactly right. We'll start with this gentleman right here in the front.
Thank you very much. My name is Nii Akwete. I'm from Ghana, but I've worked on U.S. foreign policy here in Washington for decades. Thank you very much for your remarks. I have friends who will think that I gave you some talking points, only on some, because we agree so much, including put the interests of the African partners, worry about those as well. 2 years ago, I was worried about AFRICOM's role in Mali, and I wrote a piece because I didn't think it would go well. If you don't mind, I'd like to give you a copy. And now, of course, I'm worried about what has gone on there. The country has fallen apart. And last month, I testified in the Africa subcommittee. So my question is, I have a two-part question. Would you please use your influence to have the Armed Services Committee hold a hearing to look into what has happened in Mali? Because we really don't know all the facts. The Washington Post stories make that clear. So would you please consider a hearing? And the other part is, would you also consider bringing AFRICOM's permanent headquarters to the U.S. For the sake of jobs and conditions of service for the personnel? And Mr. Cunningham, I have two African ladies here with me. There are about 4 million African-born people here and their families. I think they are a great resource that the U.S. can use in outcompeting China. So please consider that. Thank you.
I think both of those are worthy concerns. And I think, you know, Mali is certainly very disappointing because there was great promise there. Millennium Challenge Corporation, you know, went in there. They're one of the key countries that we set up a relationship with. And MCC is all about, you know, again, bottom up, develop a plan. But I will say that I think Mali is also a decent model of what I was saying earlier, that absent security, development doesn't happen. They lost control of the northern part of the country, which is an enormous patch of land, and they lost control of security. And ironically, I think the military members who led the coup led it in part because they were frustrated because the government wasn't doing enough to deal with that problem. And then in leading that coup, of course, they further empowered the very forces that they were concerned about. So I think a breakdown in security was a big part of the problem there, and that's something that we're going to have to work to solve. And then the idea of moving AFRICOM back to the U.S., I'll certainly take it under advisement. And, you know, that was one of the controversies, and you know, where do we put it? Are we going to put it in Africa or wound up with it in Germany? But I think certainly that's a reasonable suggestion. I have not heard the argument that because there are so many people of African descent in the U.S. that there could be a stronger connection there, certainly, than having it in Europe. So
it might just be easier if you
know. Sure. Yeah, I'm telling a number of hands there. But yes, we'll work our way back here. Go ahead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rosemary Segel. I'm the president of a company and an organization. I'm from Kenya, based here in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, American Security Project and Congressman. I had spoken to General Petraeus and the former AFRICOM Commander Watts about partnership. And thank you so much for speaking about partnership, because I was telling them AFRICOM and the American security needs to work with civil society. Civil society on the table, women, especially who are transparent more than men, on the table to sit and talk about security in Africa. You talked about Kenyan violence in the election. My nephew was one of those who were killed in the Kenya 2007. So we are coming up with this election, and we really want your support on capacity building and training of Kenyans so that we don't have the same problem. Looking at it, I was just going to comment on AFRICOM in Germany. He talked of AFRICOM being in America. AFRICOM should go to Africa, because that's where it's supposed to be whenever there is emergency or enemies, and that's where it needs to be. So involve us, me, our organizations, African organizations based here, to collaborate and be partners of the African Security Project and the AFRICOM. Thank you.
Thank you. And one of the most encouraging things that happened when I was in Kenya is we met with a group of young people who are doing democracy training right now. They have a huge group of folks that are all dedicated to getting people to vote, but not just getting them to vote, getting them to understand the democratic process. And part of that is understanding that within the democratic process, you lose on occasion, and that's okay. It's about the larger process, not about any one individual. And this, we had lunch with this group of young people that were out there doing that. It was incredibly inspiring. So I think they're hope for a better result this time. Yes, go ahead. Bo, you first. The gentleman in front first, then you. We go up, and now move to the right.
I think you mean me?
Yes.
Warren Durrell, USA Today. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Mali. What's the plan there? How is that going to be handled? What should happen there? Is it going to happen? And how much of a threat to the United States is the AQIM, Al-Qaeda network that's sort of in charge of the northern part of the country there?
Take the last part of the question first. I think at this point it's a pretty low-grade threat to the U.S., and that's one of the things that we're trying to figure out when we monitor the spread of Al-Qaeda and their ideology, is how those threats pop up. A lot of it is locally driven. Al-Shabaab for a long time was locally driven, and Algeria was locally driven. And that's a problem, certainly, but our chief concern, national security-wise, is, you know, do we have transnational terrorists? Are they attempting to strike at Western targets more broadly, in the U.S. or in Europe or elsewhere, or are they fighting a more local battle? And it's always difficult to tell. Al-Shabaab was considered to be a locally driven group for a long time, then they sort of expanded out, affiliated with Al-Qaeda. One of my hopes, by the way, is that the Al-Shabaab experience will make it clear that affiliating with Al-Qaeda is not a wise move, that it puts you in a position of vulnerability you just assume not be in. But that's still developing in terms of what the movement, you know, Boko Haram in Nigeria, the folks in Mali, the folks who are still in Algeria, they seem to be a more locally driven group, but that's, as we've learned in Yemen as well, that's true until it's not. So we've got to keep a very careful eye on it and see how it spreads. But more largely, they destabilize a region, and we'd rather not have that destabilization. And I think the secret, again, is security and building partnerships. Now, one of the things that hamstrings us in this is, as I mentioned earlier, we want to build partnerships with legitimate governments, not with illegitimate governments. You don't build partnerships with someone who just sponsored a coup and overthrew a democratically elected government. We had this problem in Mauritania as well. So we're going to look for partners in the region. There are countries in that area, certainly Ghana, Burkina Faso, other countries that we can work with to build partnerships to try to build security. But for right now, it's not going to be a controllable situation. We're not in a position to simply go into Mali and fix it. We're going to have to slowly rebuild a legitimate government in Mali so that we can then begin to partner with them on security. I think that's the key. Yes?
Lauren Block with the Congressional Research Service. You've given a really good overview, I think, of the issues at play with U.S.-Africa relations today. I'm curious, in your talk about partnership, your committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee over the last 6 years have given DOD new authorities to fund these types of partnership programs.
Right.
And those are activities that had been traditionally funded by the State Department through the FMF account, peacekeeping account. And those monies are shrinking in this current budget environment. Do you see those 12 series authorities as becoming a permanent piece of the DOD funding puzzle, or is this something you see eventually going back to the State Department?
Well, I hope that at least a portion of it will be permanent. And some of those, like 1206, is State Department driven with Department of Defense as a partner. So I think that those are critical pieces. And this is a matter of great controversy. I've done a lot of work with the development community. I've worked on global poverty and world development outside of the armed services realm. They don't haven't historically had a very positive view of the military. It's a different role. They don't think that the military should be doing development. And so there's been that hostility. In the last decade or so, partnerships have begun to be built in a way that I think is breaking that down in a positive direction. I think the Department of Defense needs to be involved in development because security and development go hand in hand. And if you draw that line, okay, you're security, we're development, you miss out on the ability to build partnerships that are going to be absolutely necessary. Now, is DOD doing too much? Probably. I think some of that should transition back over to the State Department. But I think it is incredibly helpful if we can break out of that old mold that says DOD should have nothing to do with this. They need to have something to do with it because, again, absent security, you don't have development. You know, look at Afghanistan. They can't do a lot of the development projects that they want to do because they don't have security. So that partnership is going to be necessary. And to the extent that DOD has a little bit of a hand in development, that makes that partnership, I think, easier to build. Yes, all the way. Sorry. Yes, ma'am, all the way in the back.
It's actually a follow on Ms. Plock's question. So I think she was asking, I'm not sure, but a broader question about the security assistance pieces that are being funded out of the each year the NDAAs are giving new military aid authorities, either as a permanent law in Title 10 or as a several year trial period. So if as we've tallied, the DOD budget now can provide for about 20 different authorities with more assistance like activities, most of them security aid, some of them development related.
Right.
So if the DOD is going to become a bigger player in providing money for foreign assistance like that.
Has become,
yes,
I would say.
Has
yes.
become, for sure. So then shouldn't you also have to become, shouldn't the DOD have to become transparent in terms of what it's providing? State Department sends to the Hill every year a congressional presentation document, what it plans to do, and reports on previous year expenditures.
Right.
DOD doesn't have to do anything like that. There's no forward-looking accountability. I know the first line of defense are going to say this is all contingency-driven, but it's not all contingency-driven. Nobody plans like the DOD plans.
Okay. I wasn't going to say that, by the way.
So is there any reason why the DOD should not be, you spoke very rightly about about democracy, important focus on democracy abroad with this assistance. A key part of that is transparency, being public and accountable about what we're doing with whom we're doing it. That's both for our democracy here and the ones abroad. So is there some reason why we shouldn't be expecting some accountability, some transparency, and oversight, or increasing
There is some accountability. There is some oversight. There is some transparency. It's wrong to say that there's not. We certainly, on the committee, we have oversight over this. We make those decisions. We've had many battles over many of these authorities and whether or not they should be continued. But you are correct to say that the transparency is not as great as it is in the State Department. And I think that's a very legitimate point. If they're going to move more in that direction, there should be greater transparency. And that's part. I mean, historically, Department of Defense is a little more jumpy about that sort of thing. In the security world, you want to keep a certain, close hold on what you're doing and where you're doing it. But I think we could probably strike a better balance on that. I think that's a very legitimate point.
Can I call your staff?
My staff's here. They heard you. Yes.
Mark Jacobson of the German Marshall Fund and formerly the Deputy NATO Representative in Afghanistan. So I've watched this civilian-military interface very closely the last couple of years. I wanted to echo something that was said earlier on AFRICOM, just to pile this on to keep it in front of your mind. We've seen CENTCOM have a U.S.-based headquarters and a forward-deployed headquarters, and that, I think, could resolve some of the political antibodies that are in the system against the permanent headquarters being in Africa. But I do think there's a very good case for a home base and an overseas operationally focused headquarters. And to follow up on the second theme, I really applaud the work you've done over the last several years to kind of narrow this gap between, let's say, Title 22 and Title 10, development and military operations. I agree that security must be a prerequisite to development. So I'm wondering, what are the next steps in terms of changes to Title 10, and probably more importantly, although out of the Armed
Much
Services,
more.
And,
go ahead,
and it's not just a matter of money, it's enabling Office of Transition Initiatives at OTI, who've just started a crisis response capability, or just about to kick that off, but again, I think there's no way, as parochial as I am towards the Special Forces, they cannot do stabilization, that middle ground, and development nearly as effectively as AID can in a consistent way. So how do we fix this?
Single biggest thing is to actually reform our development policy in a way that makes it more functional. And this has been one of my greatest disappointments of the last 3.5 years, is there is a clear model for how to do development policy better than we do it. And we have steadfastly refused to make even one step of progress towards working towards that better model. And the model I use is the Department for International Development in Great Britain. What's different about the way they do development policy than the way we do it? First of all, it's coordinated. The person who is in charge of the Department for International Development actually controls about 95% of the development money. In the U.S., it's spread all over hell. Nobody, well, theoretically, the Secretary of State is in charge of development policy, but since the Secretary of State is primarily in charge of diplomacy, it's impossible for that person to be in charge of it. We could not possibly have a better Secretary of State on development policy. Just couldn't. And yet the State Department still is not able to prioritize it the way that I think it should be. And that makes perfect sense. You might have noticed there's a couple of diplomatic issues going on out there in the world. Peace in the Middle East, what are we going to do about China, what are we going to do about North Korea, Iran, all that. You know, development policy is always going to be secondary to diplomacy within the State Department, which means it's not going to get the attention that it deserves, and it's not going to get the support that it deserves. And then we also couldn't possibly have a better USAID director. Raj Shah is brilliant, doing a fabulous job, doing the best he possibly can with what's in front of him. But what's in front of him is he doesn't really control development policy because he's got a good chunk of the money, but he's got no say over it. I mentioned the Millennium Challenge Corporation, PEPFAR, whole series of different issues. In fact, there was just something that happened yesterday that made this even worse. I forget, I'm looking at Katie, she sent me an email about this. There's another for the Global Health Fund. The Global Health Fund will not be under USAID. Brilliant. One more thing within development policy is going to be scattered off into the wind. So you can consolidate those programs, elevate the importance of USAID, and this, by the way, is part of the problem with the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense looks at the way our development policy is structured and says, yeah, I don't trust these people. They're not structured in a way to be effective, so we're going to do it. You know, reference my earlier comment about how can you do it, the answer is always yes. And I will say, and I'm biased, of course, because I do a lot of work with special operations forces and military in general, I think they're doing a pretty darn good job. When you look at where they were like plopped down in the middle of Iraq and Afghanistan, and all of a sudden they had to be, development experts and all these other things they've never trained to do, they figured it out pretty quick and did a pretty darn good job. Now, it's not ideal. I'd rather have the development experts doing it. But given the, try not to swear when I'm on television, the messed up nature of the development, it's hard to disagree with. You know what? We're just going to do it, okay? So, single most important thing is reform development policy. if the central pillars of our foreign policy are supposed to be defense, diplomacy, and development, that third piece of it just isn't working as well as it should because it's not structured to work well. I'm not even talking about spending more money on it. Just spend what you've got there now better and more effectively. And the final thing I'll say about this, so you flipped the switch on me there. This is a very important issue to me. You know, even the money that Raj does control over at USAID is broken down into so many different pots that he has very little flexibility. A problem may pop up on food security and say, well, gosh, we need some money for this. Well, no, that money has to go to, you know, educating girls in Latin America. It's in that pot. Or this money has to go to, you know, tuberculosis in I don't know where. And you can't take it out of that pot because Congress has put it in there. We have taken our development arm and just throttled it and then expected it to succeed. We've got to come up with a better system. That's the most important thing that can happen. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Gwendolyn Michael, Georgetown University. I am really appreciative of the development that you laid out, the partnership within AFRICOM development security. My question goes to the point you made about fragmentation and within and the model of the UK. And I want to focus on that because it strikes me that we have taken a more unilateral approach to how we're going to integrate development and security over the last few years. Leaped back about 5 years or so, we were part of GA, we were part of talking about what the agenda was going to be for Africa on security and on development. And I'm trying to figure out whether our success or failures now have in Mali or Congo have to do with a unilateral approach that really can't be effective because we don't have the capacity to do it all there. I can contrast that with Kenya and Somalia, where I believe we've taken a more multilateral approach.
No question.
And so I'm wondering what you think about what the future is for the way we're going in terms of working with our partners on that kind of issue. And if I take that multilateral a little further and take it to Congo, trying to figure out why we're not also doing the kinds of things we're doing multilaterally, in Kenya and Somalia to deal with the issues. I know we're working on LRA and all of that.
Right.
But why are we working, do I not know something? Are we not working multilaterally in a way that would make sense of the challenge?
Let me answer that last piece first. I mean, the main reason that we're not working, I hope to build towards that. The main reason is because Al-Shabaab and what's going on in Somalia is perceived as a direct threat to the U.S. So we are more interested in that area than we are interested in the Eastern Congo. That's just the fact. So we worked with Kenya, we worked with Ethiopia, we went to Djibouti, Uganda, to focus on dealing with the problem in Somalia. Now, the second reason, and it applies in Somalia as well, is you need a local partner. I'm not going to say that we had more of a local partner in Somalia than we had in Eastern Congo. Same problem was there. But one of the other impediments to actually getting more actively engaged in the Eastern Congo is that the Eastern Congo is a little too strong a statement to say ungoverned, but it's close. Kinshasa is a long way away. And there's not a lot of security structure there. Ideally, we would go in and we would work with some Congolese government entity, police force, military, whatever. They're not very effective. In many cases, they're part of the problem. They are preying on the citizenry as well. But again, you can look at Somalia and say, it didn't like Somalia was any better in that regard. And we dove in and found a way to make it work there because it was more of a priority. So I think we can do that. And address the other point that you made about working in a more multilateral. I don't know if it's gotten any worse in the last few years, but I think we do tend to have a more unilateral approach than we should, and the whole theme of this is building partnerships. But that's why I'll go back to, we got to get our development policy right, because then there's force multipliers beyond that. You know, you've got the local countries, obviously, that you want to work with. There is an unbelievable number of NGOs globally that are interested in a wide variety of these issues. We can work with them and we can better use those resources. And then there are, we work with Great Britain and all that, but we don't have our own development policy as straight as it should, so it's hard to build those partnerships. And that's one of the frustrating aspects of development policy for me is,
there's so much money, there's so many people doing so many things that they're stepping on each other constantly. There's a lack of coordination. And I think the U.S. needs to take a much stronger leadership role in building that coordination. Yeah, some hands, I'll go up here. Go ahead.
Emily Cadet, I'm with Congressional Quarterly, and I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit more about the presence of the CIA and drones in Africa, because we're hearing increasing reports of that. I'm curious if you think there's enough oversight of that, and if that risks risking some of the partnerships that you spoke about, because obviously local populations cannot be particularly enthusiastic about those sorts of presences on their soil.
I mean, it depends on what the presence brings about. Intel is part of what we're going to do there. I think the local population in Mali would be real excited if we were providing them intel on what's going on in the north of their country that they can't get access to. So I don't buy, and I know this, I've read the stories, the stories have this sort of ominous overtone that isn't this a huge problem. I kind of disagree with that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but intel has to be part of the partnership that we're talking about here. That can be part of the capacity building that's necessary to help deal with the problem. And, you know, the hunt for the Lord's Resistance Army and Joseph Kony, gotta know where he is. I don't see Uganda, you know, having the type of ISR capability that's gonna let him know who's there. Intel's part of it. And that's, you know, and intel by its very nature is not something that you wanna put on television, sorry, or in the newspaper. So there has to be a certain secret aspect to it. So it's a challenge. You got to do it right, and it's got to be with the local partners. You don't want to be showing up without their knowledge. You want to work with them in a cooperative way. But that's different than saying we want to blast it all over the newspapers and make it completely transparent every single intel operation that we're running anywhere in the world. That I would be opposed to.
Do you have oversight over it? I mean, do you feel like?
Oh yes, we have oversight over it. I don't want to paralyze them by saying you can't do anything without talking to all 535 of us first. But we have an intel committee, we have an armed services committee, we have many hearings and many discussions. I am in the SCIF, the intel place, at least, you know, 2-3 times a week having these conversations, as are a lot of other members. Yes.
E.J. Hoekner with the National Crisis Group. On a more macro level, how do you balance the signals that the U.S. sends to these local partners with the ability of the United States to be critical? So, for example, Uganda is a very important partner in Somalia.
Right.
Ethiopia is a very important partner, obviously, arguably also in Somalia and certainly in Sudan. At the same time, there's a perception in the continent, and certainly among some people who follow the Horn of Africa, that both those countries got a pass the last time they had elections, and those elections weren't really in a free and fair playing field.
There's a long, long-winded version of this, but the answer is it's hard because of the point that I made earlier. You want legitimacy for that government, and that legitimacy is very important. They don't have it if there's a transparency, if there, you know, if there's too much corruption, and I think we have to continually try to push them in that direction. And part of the argument we can make is, look, you're not going to be successful if your population isn't behind you. But that's not always going to work. And you have to balance that and make it difficult. I do believe that it's not as simple as it's often portrayed, that, you know, if some country's doing something wrong, you have to cut them off in order to force them to do something right. I think it's a series of very difficult diplomatic choices in a very complicated chess game that you need able diplomats to play. Now, I think we do have to push these countries for all the reasons I stated up front, that, you know, you have to have a better human rights record, you have to have a more transparent, more legitimate government if you're going to be successful. But it's not always easy. It's a very, very difficult part of it. Yes, and I got to go in the back.
John Tully with the BBC. You mentioned partnerships several times, and I'm curious as to how you see a role for Europe in Africa as a whole. Somewhat of a broad question. And then in terms of the Lord's Resistance Army, it could be seen as throwing a cup of tea on a house fire in terms of U.S. efforts. And I think trying to explain sort of the strategy that has been taken by this administration, do you feel it's effective in your personal opinion? Do you think that this is the right stance at the right time?
I do, yeah. And I think that's because there's a bit of a misunderstanding out there about what we're doing with the Lord's Resistance Army and what's happened there. It has been portrayed in the media because it's simple and straightforward to say we're going to get Joseph Kony. And that's what it's all about. And you go, well, Joseph Kony, he's one guy, there's all sorts of stuff going on. Really, you're going to focus all that energy and effort there. That's not what it's about.
What it's about is partnership building. We are building the capacity and the partnership that we have, in this case, very specifically with Uganda. They're going after the LRA, but that's but one step in the larger issue. And that's really misunderstood. And I think timing was part of it. The plan to begin working with the Ugandans to go after the LRA was being thought about and developed long before the Invisible Children put out the video and made Joseph Kony, this internationally known person. Oh, good, they're going to get him. That's not really what it's about. The partnership that you're talking about, all partnerships start with one project here, one project there, you work on it. We're also working with the Ugandans to get them more involved in what's going on in Somalia to build their capacity as well. And when you look at the LRA, they cross over a lot of lines into the Eastern Congo. Potential to build a partnership with the Eastern Congo, as I talked about earlier. Central African Republic, potential there. South Sudan. All of that is part of a larger partnership. If, in fact, the sole reason we were doing all of this was to kill or capture Joseph Kony, then yeah, that would not be a wise policy. But that's not what it's about. It's about the larger partnership building that hopefully can lead, ideally, if you want to talk about the specific huge problem, the Eastern Congo. If we could, use those partnerships to help bring greater stability to there, that would be enormously important. And as far as Europe, that's why I mentioned different. I think it's an incredibly important partnership. Obviously, they have historical connections to Africa, not always good, but nonetheless, they do have knowledge of the area and are actively involved and engaged. And we've seen that in Salt and Libya, so much of other places where those relationships and those partnerships can be helpful. I gotta give folks in the back here a chance.
We've got just under 5 minutes.
Okay, I'll take three more. You two and then all the way in the back. I'll take the three in the back. You two and then the woman in the red in the back there. Go ahead. Yes, sir. You can start.
Thank you very much, my name is Fred Olodembe, which is from Congress in Africa. And thank you for your remarks. I wanted to ask you a question in order to achieve that golden opportunity you've talked about. How do you see trade being used as a tool to reinforce the security efforts and campaigns that have been made? We know that the AGOA clause is coming to an end. September.
A piece of it.
A piece of it.
Yeah, an important piece.
And we also know
that
by 2015, we would be seeing an end to it. If you were looking at a prism, how do you see the United States using trade in Africa to encourage and improve democracy? Given the fact that we have players like China that may not have the same interest in terms of human rights and democracy as major stakeholders.
I think it's critically important, as Nelson cued me up quite well to start something I've worked on. Ultimately, that trade is much better than a one-off aid project. Sorry, just if you can build the capacity of a country to grow economically, and trade's going to be important. As I mentioned in Uganda, you got all those bananas, a whole lot of people out there would buy them. If we could build the trade, give them something, then they grow economically and it creates opportunity. I think trade is absolutely critical to it and a great opportunity for the U.S., again, both for exports and imports, to build that relationship. So I think extending the, Third Nation textile provision in AGOA is incredibly important. And I'm all for expanding. I've been a sponsor of a bill for a while that's duty-free, quota-free for the 50 poorest nations in the world. Whatever we can do to enhance those relationships and partnerships will be very beneficial to Africa, but I think beneficial to us as well. Yes, ma'am. Yes, you.
Me?
Yes.
Okay. Just following up on that gentleman's question about Ethiopia. You have a very unstable character in Ethiopia with Manasseh Nabi, really a dictator running that country. And are you just saying that because you have security interests and you just deny that this brutal dictator happens to, Ethiopia? In fact, told us that in 2010, the election you won it by 99.6% and a 547 member parliament, there's one opposition.
That's a little hard to believe, yes.
So how do you reconcile this, hypocrisy of this policy? If you rail against Mugabe and we let us alone, people are going to say, what is with American foreign policy, right?
And the answer I gave was difficult. I think you do have to put pressure on them. We've done that in places before. I mean, we had huge security interests in Mauritania. They had a coup. We stopped doing business with them. Same thing just happened in Mali. So, no, I think you do have to put pressure. And each individual situation is going to be different. And it's not easy. It's like I said, you don't want to reach a position where, you know, if someone does something that is not what we want them to do, we're done, we're not having any relationship with them. On the other hand, you don't want to, you know, just turn away because you have interest there. I agree. I think every single country is going to be very difficult. I wouldn't want to have to be the diplomat making those decisions, because you want greater freedom, you want greater democracy, greater opportunity, less corruption, all of those things. But the ability of an outside country to force another country to do that, it's an art, not a science. We can push them, and we should. No, I wouldn't say at all that you simply turn a blind eye if you have interest. That's what I think got us in trouble in the first place. That's what undermined our ability to have those relationships. But it's simply not that easy. I mean, you have to figure out how to maintain a partnership and build that relationship while pushing them at the same time. It's a very difficult diplomatic line to walk.
But nothing has been done, you know, in the case of Ethiopia. I mean, President Obama talks about eloquently about building, you know, strong institutions. Africa needs strong institutions, not strong men. But then, on the other hand, if U.S. policy supports these strong men in Uganda and
right.
Ethiopia.
Yeah, I think that is a very, very legitimate point. And something that we need to work on. But if the solution is to say, okay, Ethiopia, Uganda, you're off the list, we're not going to have any relationship with you, you could go a long way towards saying that. Now, there's a good deal of distance between what we're doing and what I just proposed, and I would say we need to find some of that distance to put greater pressure on countries like Ethiopia and Uganda, not simply do what they want. I would be supportive of you in saying that we ought to do that, certainly, to try to push them towards greater freedom, greater democracy, without a doubt. Yes, sir. That is an outstanding idea, and I think that level of cultural awareness is a huge part of being successful, true in the military, true in the State Department. Because again, I think the thing about, it's got to be bottom-up, it's got to be driven by the local population, the better understanding you have, and no two countries in Africa are the same. You know, areas in the same country. You have to have a cultural understanding of who you're dealing with if you're going to be able to build a successful partnership that's helpful to them. And that's one asset that we have that we should certainly deploy. Well, thank you. The question's outstanding. I wish I could have taken them all. But it's been a great discussion. I hope this will continue. This is a critical area of public policy that I'm going to keep working on.
Thank you, Congressman. There are two things that are just eminently clear to me after this morning's question session. First, the pent-up demand for thoughtful leadership on Africa is incredible. Just look at the numbers of people we have this morning. Look at the intensity and thoughtfulness of the questions that were put. And the second thing that's clear to me is that we're all really lucky to have Adam Smith thinking about these issues. So thank you, Congressman, and thanks for coming this morning.
Thanks.